Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Blurred Lines, The Loop and Guevara. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. Somewhere else in the UK is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there, how are you?
I'm all right. The clocks have just gone forward, so that's good.
What you're giving away there is that we're recording this podcast a little bit later than we would usually on a Sunday morning. So it'll have a Sunday morning feeling.
It'll have a vibe that we can call our own.
The Sunday morning vibe edition. We are also, because we're recording this on a Sunday morning, we haven't both gone into central London, into the studio on a Sunday morning. We haven't dragged in Matt, our producer, to record us on a Sunday morning. We're recording on a Sunday because I was out and about again last week. I had a very fleeting trip to Bucharest for the really rather good Mastering the Music Business event that is third year it's happened, second time we've been involved. So I was in Bucharest on our recording day. I couldn't then do it on Friday because I was teaching. So we've ended up doing it on a Sunday morning. So this week, I think for the first time ever, we are both recording from home.
Yeah, you've never recorded from home before.
No, not from my home. I've recorded from my Edinburgh Festival home. Mm-hmm. And I do think I've recorded from Cheshire at least once. So I have recorded from sort of in-houses rather than studios. But I think on those occasions you were in the studio. And then on all occasions you've recorded from home, or that time you recorded from the south of France, if I remember rightly, I was in the studio. So it's never been both of us recording in weird little corners of houses. It's interesting how you think you live somewhere quite peaceful, and then when you set up your recording device on your desk, you suddenly realise, I don't think anywhere in London is actually that peaceful. I live quite near a railway line. I've never realised quite how noisy the trains are when they go past. So who knows what you'll get in the background of this edition of the podcast. It may sound a little bit tinny. It may sound a little bit echoey. There might be lots of things going on in the background. But that's what podcasts are all about, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the unprofessional sound of podcasts. Is that what you're saying?
So not only do we have a Sunday vibe on this edition of Setlist, we also have a refreshingly amateur audio quality within the podcast ethos. So I think that's all of the get-outs out of the way for this week's edition. And let's hope that we don't have to rely too much on those get-outs. Perhaps it'll turn out that the sound will be brilliant, the content will be brilliant, it'll just sound great, and then I'll just cut this entire intro out. So yes. It might be that we go straight from you saying, hi, Chris, into the first story because none of these get-out footnotes were required.
Well, I know that the sound quality will be immaculate on my end, so it's all down to you now.
Well, you've had lots of practice. I mean, if it happens to be that my sound quality ain't great and Andy sounds brilliant, I would like you to go back into the archives for the editions where Andy recorded from his home for the first time. And you will discover that it did take a few goes, didn't it, for you to work out how to turn your little residence into a podcast recording studio.
Well, yes, maybe.
And I'm still learning, I think, is the message there. Anyway, we better get on with this edition of Setlist.
Yes, okay then. Well, coming up this week, we've got a new report calling for changes to the UK's drug policy and more embarrassment for Guevara as it goes to court. But first, the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court in the US last week upheld the ruling in the high-profile Blurred Lines song theft case, confirming that Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke did indeed infringe Marvin Gaye's copyright in his song Got to Give It Up when they wrote Blurred Lines in 2013. Possibly early. It was released in 2013.
Yes, so obviously this is the long-awaited appeal to that incredibly high-profile, I think probably the highest-profile copyright infringement case in recent time.
Even higher profile than Stairway to Heaven. Imagine that.
Yeah, that did get quite a lot of press, but I think this one has grabbed even more headlines. So to quickly recap what happened before, I have a feeling the first time round of this case might have been in those couple of years where we weren't doing the podcast. Am I right in saying that? Or somewhere in the archive is everything I'm about to say pre-recorded on the previous edition?
I feel like we did discuss it on the podcast, but it was a while ago, so I don't know.
It was a while ago. So Robin Thicke, Pharrell Williams went into the studio and created that monstrosity of an incredibly catchy pop track that was Blurred Lines. And then, while on the promo circuit for that record, Robin Thicke let it slip in a media interview that when he had gone into the studio with Pharrell to create Blurred Lines, by far his biggest hit to date.
Many would say his only hit.
Well, certainly his only hit that here in the UK we would be aware of. When he went into the studio with Pharrell to write that record, he said to Pharrell, hey, I love Marvin Gaye. I love this specific Marvin Gaye track. Let's write something of that vibe. And that was sort of where this entire case began, in a magazine interview. That then led to some chatter of, oh my God, is Blurred Lines a ripoff of the Marvin Gaye track? Got to give it up. And then, weirdly, it was Robin Thicke and Pharrell who went legal first.
Yes.
They filed legal action to get court clarification to confirm that there was no copyright infringement between Gotta Give It Up and Blurred Lines. They may share a vibe, one may be influenced by the other, but no copyright infringement. On the back of that, the Marvin Gaye estate then sued for copyright infringement, resulting in a very entertaining jury trial in which, it was the pretrial depositions that were particularly amusing, wasn't it? Where Robin Thicke, who, while promoting Blurred Lines, had talked up how him and Pharrell had really collaborated on this track and his involvement in it, subsequently in deposition said, oh, I didn't have any involvement in writing this track. I was out on it on prescription medication at the time. Pharrell went into the studio. He did all the work. I just showed up and did my lyrics. And then Pharrell just talked nonsense for 10 minutes and nobody really knew what he was saying. So the depositions before the trial were particularly entertaining, although Robin Thicke did show up for the court case itself. So we had all of the arguments presented in court, the classic with any song theft case, a musicologist on one side saying, these are definitely the same song, and a musicologist on the other side saying, these are totally different songs. But in the end, the jury hearing the case decided that the two songs were similar enough to constitute copyright infringement, and they awarded the Marvin Gaye estate significant damages and 50% of the Blurred Lines copyright.
Yes, but Pharrell and Robin Thicke did not agree with that ruling for some reason, and they appealed. And last week, that appeal received a ruling in which the ruling was upheld, and they still owe the Gays $5.5 million.
Yeah, so the appeals court pretty much upheld most, not all, but most of what happened first time round.
They let T.I. off the hook.
Yeah, it was actually the judge in the original case who decided that T.I., who raps on the record, and Interscope, who released the track, should also be held liable for this copyright infringement. Because I suppose, quick copyright technicality point, was that the case was centred on the song copyright, not the recording copyright. So the core allegation was that the Blurred Lines song infringed the Got to Give It Up song, not that the Blurred Lines recording infringed the Got to Give It Up recording. Which is why Interscope reckoned they shouldn't be part of this, because they have no stake in the actual song copyright. T.I. said, seemingly fair enough, he just showed up and did a rap. That rap definitely doesn't rip off Got to Give It Up. So neither of those should have been held liable. But the judge in the original trial decided that they should be. However, on appeal, the appeals judges said no, liability should not be extended to either of them. The jury didn't think so, and it wasn't for the judge at the end of the case to add liabilities to them. So that was the one little change that the appeal judges made. But in the main, they upheld the original ruling, although, and I think one of the reasons why this appeal ruling has got quite a lot of coverage across the press in the last 7 days is, although two of the three judges, considering the appeal, upheld the original ruling, one of the three judges gave a dissenting ruling. So it was a 2-1 victory, which was meant the original ruling was upheld. But the dissenting judge was incredibly scathing in her write-up of her colleagues, and I suppose really backing up the main argument that was coming from the Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke camp ever since the original ruling, which was declaring Blurred Lines as a rip-off on a copyright infringement of Got to Give It Up sets an incredibly dangerous precedent for the songwriting community.
Yes, Judge Jacqueline Wynne said that the other two judges were allowing the Gays to accomplish what no one has before, copyright a musical style. So she very much sided with the Pharrell and Robin Thicke side of saying that there was no infringement of the song, that both songs shared the same vibe, and you can't copyright a vibe. But now the court has allowed the Gays to copyright a vibe. She said that this establishes a dangerous precedent that strikes a devastating blow to future musicians and composers everywhere.
So that was pretty tough talking from the dissenting judge. She very much siding with the Pharrell and Thicke camp. And I mean, as the appeal was going through the motions, there was a whole line of songwriters and music people who backed up Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams and said that they didn't think that the courts should be ruling that this was a copyright infringement. Because of course, it's no secret that in songwriting, most songwriters are inspired by things that have gone before. Marvin Gaye was famously inspired by lots of music that had gone before.
Well, yeah.
And I suppose that makes this the classic, when does inspiration become infringement, case. Copyright law law isn't really very helpful on this point, probably because actually it's impossible in sort of clear writing to define when inspiration should become infringement. But what Farrell and Fick and this dissenting judge was saying was that the jury in the original case here drew the line in the wrong place.
The other two judges in the case did not agree with her, and they described what she wrote about all this as unfounded hyperbole. They said that she'd acted improperly as an appeals judge, trying to act as judge, jury and executioner in a case that had already been through a jury trial, and that is not what appeals judges are supposed to do. They also said that their decision doesn't grant any copyright to a musical style or groove, as they put it, and it doesn't upset, as they described it, the balance Congress struck between the freedom of artistic expression on the one hand and the copyright protection of the fruits of that expression on the other hand. Basically, no vibe has been copyrighted. Stop saying that.
Yeah, it was interesting reading what the two judges who carried the judgment said about the dissenting judge, and in particular that point you've just referenced, that they felt that she wasn't following the process that the appeals court is meant to go through, whereas you felt that the dissenting judge, I suppose, was saying that this sets such a dangerous precedent in American copyright law that the appeals court almost had a duty to overturn what the jury had reached. And I suppose the involvement of the jury in trials like this, I mean, you wouldn't get a jury in a copyright case here in the UK. It is something that comes up quite a lot in the US, and it's interesting because when you have a copyright case which is quite complicated, and there were a number of complexities to the Blurred Lines case, I mean, for example, what exactly was protected by copyright? Because the general assumption under American copyright law is that because you have copyright registration in America, what is protected when there is a dispute over a piece of work is the work as registered with the US Copyright Office when the work was first published. And because Got to Give It Up is quite an old song, back in the era when it was registered with the American Copyright Office, you could only log sheet music, not sound recordings. And so therefore the argument is, and Farrell and Fick's side put this argument forward, only the song as represented in the sheet music, as submitted with the American Copyright Office, only that is protected by copyright. And anything else that was added in Marvin Gaye's famous recording of the song, they are part of the recording, but remember, this dispute wasn't over the recording copyright, but they are not part of the song copyright. And that was very much part of Fick and Farrell's argument in court, and actually, on that point, the judge in the original trial sided with Fick and Farrell and said, yeah, you're right, that is a correct interpretation of American copyright law. And yet, Fick and Farrell's lawyers would argue that although the judge sided with them on that technicality very early on in the original Blurred Lines trial, once the case was up and running, that perhaps that technicality wasn't enforced as strongly as it could have been. And I suspect that in some ways the dissenting judge's concerns perhaps come from this idea of, is a jury qualified to make a judgment on something where you've got all of these complexities involved in the case, given that it is possibly setting quite a big precedent for American copyright law, and so therefore should judges with their expertise be saying, yeah, the jury got it wrong in that case, we should change it in order to stop this precedent going through. Whereas the other two judges were saying, that's not our job, you're overstepping your remit.
Now, we haven't had a proper response from the Thick and Williams camp yet. I assume that there's going to be more appeals in this case. This isn't the end of it.
Yeah, given the amount of money involved, over $5 million, as you say, plus a share of the future Blurred Lines income for the Gaye estate, I suspect that all appeal routes probably will be pursued. And of course, there were plenty of people in the songwriting community and the legal community, not all, some think that this is the right ruling, but I would say that more music lawyers and certainly more songwriters who I've spoken to feel that this actually is the wrong ruling. And so therefore, I think there will be quite a lot of support for the Fick and Farrell side to take this as far as they can and see whether or not we can get any future appeals. You mentioned the Stairway to Heaven case, which was, I suppose, is the other song theft case that had quite a lot of press coverage in recent years. That is also waiting to go before some appeals judges. And that technicality about what is exactly copyright protected is also part of that case too. So I think we'll get the appeals judgment in the Stairway to Heaven case next, but it wouldn't surprise me if there is not further stages in the courts on the whole Blurred Lines dispute down the line.
So I guess the line is still blurred.
Oh, look at that. We nearly got through the entire segment without resorting to that sort of cliche line that a lot of people put into their first paragraph on reporting that story. But hey.
I note you stopped short of calling it a joke. Rightly so.
Yes.
Still to come, some news in brief, plus new revelations about Guevara's failed IPO. But now, drug safety charity The Loop is calling for major reforms to UK drugs policy, claiming that a shift away from harm prevention in recent years has led to an increase in drug-related deaths in nightclubs in the UK.
Yeah, so this very much links into the conversation that we had during our drugs conference at The Great Escape last May, and of course the debate that occurred around the whole Fabric losing its license debacle, and more recently when a similar thing happened to the Rainbow venues in Birmingham. And the message that very much came out of the drug conference last year was a feeling amongst those people on the ground who are organising club nights and festivals that a total zero tolerance approach where licensing authorities force promoters of clubs and festivals to say no drugs in the hope that that means there'll be no drugs. Actually, that's very much a counterproductive way of going about this, because realistically, it's just a fact of life that at club nights and at festivals, a certain number of the people at those events will be taking illegal substances. And whatever you do on the door or the gate to try and stop those substances getting into the venue or onto the festival site, people will be consuming those drugs. And simply having a no, 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 we won't do that policy actually puts people at danger, because two things. First of all, it means that when people do have a bad reaction to drugs that they have taken, the people on site don't necessarily have the training in place to deal with that at the moment when it needs to be dealt with, or the festival goers, the club goers, are nervous of seeking the help from the staff. Plus, the big, big message that was repeated time and again at the drugs conference was that what we really need is everybody in the live sector doing a lot of education work to make sure that club goers and festival goers are aware of the risks, and not just the risks in general of taking drugs, but the very timely risks about the kinds of drugs that are on the market at any one time. And because clubs and festivals have been pressured often by their local licensing authorities, this does actually vary greatly as you go around the UK, but because some local authorities are very much forcing festival promoters and club promoters to say, we have a zero tolerance, there are no drugs on our site, even though we know there are, they then don't feel that they can be doing the kind of education initiatives that actually could be saving lives. And so that's the message that we had throughout the Fabric debate, the more recently around the Rainbow Venues debate at our drugs conference last year. And this charity, The Loop, have not only been taking this conversation forward, but have lots of practical ideas and solutions as to how clubs, venues, festivals could be having much more practical measures to make sure that their customers are safe if and when they have taken drugs.
Yes, so this report has been jointly published by The Loop, drug policy think tank Vaultface, Durham University, and the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Drug Policy Reform. It states that drug-related deaths and hospital admissions have risen sharply in recent years, despite drug usage rates remaining fairly static. This is due, the report says, to the government shifting its drug policy and resources away from harm prevention, with the zero tolerance policies that venues now generally adopt in order to adhere to the law. They stick to that very tightly because they worry about losing their license if they're seen to look after people who are having a bad time on drugs. So as a result, people in the venues don't tend to have any relevant training for what to do when things go wrong. And you get venues like Fabric and Rainbow where they really do, or did in terms of Rainbow, put effort into ensuring that there is help on hand when things go wrong. And then we see that backfire when both venues have had people die there as a result of taking drugs on site. That's then gone to the council for a license hearing, and they've lost the license partly because of their efforts to look after people.
Yeah, by being much more proactive in looking after people and being a bit more upfront and frank about drugs, what it means is they are talking often to the local police more frequently in a proactive, positive way. But then if something does go horribly wrong, even though it's a one-off, what it means is that the local police force then have records of all the conversations that they've had with those clubs in the past, which they can then use against them, versus those clubs which are much more hands-off, much less well-equipped to deal with drug issues within their event or within their venue. But because they don't have conversations with the local police, that information can't be used against them. So you sort of end up in everything being totally the wrong way round.
Well, yes.
And as I said, this organisation, The Loop, are really good for coming up with sort of practical measures that they think that either local councils or festival promoters or club owners should be introducing. And this Nightlife's report that they've published has a number of proposals as to what we should be doing here in the UK.
Yes, I suppose the big proposal is that drug safety testing services are introduced into areas in towns and cities where there are a lot of bars and clubs. I mean, this is extending what The Loop's doing at festivals already into city centres, basically, and allowing people to test the drugs that they've bought without fear of prosecution so that they know what they're taking. And if you look at the work that The Loop does, very often people find out that what they're taking is really not what they thought they'd bought.
And of course, this all links into one of the big issues in recent years, which The Loop also mentioned in this report, and we talked about at our drugs conference at the Great Escape last year, which is that the strength of the drugs, particularly ecstasy and cocaine that is on the market, has been increasing in recent years. And some people say that that was the drug dealers responding to the whole legal highs fad that was doing the rounds a few years ago, which had its own controversies around it. But that meant there was more competition in the drugs market. And so what some of the dealers were doing to compete was they were increasing the strength of the ecstasy or the cocaine. But because all of this is done on the black market, obviously there is no education, there is no communication around that. And so some of the deaths that have occurred in recent years were people who had taken drugs in the past, not realizing the strength had increased with the goods that they had bought, and taking a quantity that in the past would have been fine, but with the increased quantity, that was a fatal dosage.
Yes, so as well as providing drug safety testing services for people going to bars and clubs in the UK, it also recommends an independent information service to reduce drug-related harm, drugs awareness training for nighttime staff, and to adopt the more open drugs policies of a lot of UK festivals in licensed venues around the UK. So accepting that some people are going to take drugs and try to prevent that happening, but also protect them when things go wrong. So launching this report, the director of The Loop and the co-author of it, Fiona Meesham, said that UK nightlife makes a vital contribution to our economic and cultural life, yet we've reached an impasse. Clubs risk closure if there was a drug-related death, but they also risk closure if they attempt to introduce harm reduction measures. By contrast, UK festivals have been introducing evidence-based and effective methods to address the growing drug-related problems faced in the UK. Drawing on festival drug policy and practice, this report makes key recommendations to bolster our nighttime economy and protect the customers and venues within them.
Now, part of the aim of this report is to change the policies of both local authorities around the UK, but also the UK government itself. And you mentioned that the report was co-published by various organisations, The Loop being one of them, but also the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Drug Policy Reform, which proves that there is some support in the political community for what organisations like The Loop are saying. So All-Party Parliamentary Groups, they don't actually have any political power, but they unite MPs and Lords in Parliament who share a common issue that they are particularly passionate about. Jeff Smith is co-chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Drug Policy Reform, and he, like Fiona, initially in his quote, referenced the economic value of the nighttime economy in many of the towns and cities around the UK, stressing that issues like those that have been faced by Fabric and Rainbow venues are hindering that nighttime economy and the value that that economy delivers to those towns and cities. He said nighttime venues are at the centre of British music culture, making our cities exciting and vibrant places to live while contributing over £66 billion to the UK economy. Keeping people safe requires more than zero tolerance rhetoric around drugs and outdated licensing laws. This report offers credible and tested solutions to help protect people attending events. I hope venues, local authorities, and the government will work together to make those recommendations a reality. So there is a little bit of political momentum behind this too. So what we hope will now happen is, obviously, when Fabric lost its license, but then subsequently got its license back, they did say, we are going to carry on putting pressure on central government to provide better guidelines to local authorities on how to do this better. The whole Rainbow Venues thing in Birmingham, those guys have been very much, we want to change policies both at a national and a local level. So hopefully with those guys and organisations like The Loop and with the political support that's already in Westminster and with all the other festival and club promoters and artists on top of that, hopefully all of this conversation can be coordinated and we can actually bring about some change at a national level and then a local level, which A, will allow the good club promoters to stay in business, and B, will actually save some lives rather than just saying zero tolerance, turn a blind eye, let's just pretend nothing is happening there.
We should reference another development last week, which was that the Rainbow Venues, which we've discussed a couple of times on the podcast in its fight to reopen after being shut down and losing his licence because of a drugs-related death last October, have given up that appeal, stating that the financial and emotional strain that it was having was too much. So that's not even, in the case of Fabric, it was one venue saved, but in the case of Rainbow Venues, that's, Birmingham's just lost a lot of venues as a result of that.
Yeah, the guys who used to run that venue complex in Birmingham had, in the last month or so, indicated that they were going to move back into event production, putting on those events at other people's venues, rather than perhaps trying to get the Rainbow Venues back into business. But they have confirmed that they are no longer appealing that licensing ruling. But in their statement, they were saying that doesn't mean that they are backing away from their viewpoint on this and that they still endorse the point that we've been discussing here.
Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. The Madison Square Gardens Company this week properly unveiled plans for its new venue in East London. But shortly before that, AEG raised concerns over those plans.
Yeah, so this new venue that they're planning in East London is their first extension outside of America over here into Europe. They're planning a big sort of really high-tech sphere type venue that's going to have all sorts of VR and AR and lights and weird sound stuff going on. AEG, big competitor of MSG, and last year we saw a little bit of sparring between MSG and AEG. Because there was the allegation that MSG were pressuring artists who wanted to play Madison Square Garden in New York to also play their LA venue, which is the Forum, whereas AEG would rather artists, when they're in LA, play their venue, the Staples Center. So then AEG were starting to pressure people who wanted to play the O2 Arena in London to play the Staples Center when they were in LA. So all of this was already going on. Now MSG is planning to build a massive new venue very close to the aforementioned O2 Arena. And so AEG put out a statement just before MSG did a little unveiling of their plans, basically saying, we're not against competition. Of course we're not against competition, but this is another venue very close to the O2 Arena. It's also right next to the London Stadium, which, although predominantly sports stuff going on there, they do have big gigs there as well. And so they were basically saying, well, they were sort of blaming the Tube network, weren't they? The Jubilee line's not up to this, is what they were saying. Yeah. MSG are welcome to come to London, but not quite so close to where we are.
Yes, they are basically saying, East London is full, go away. But MSG are still forging ahead with those plans to build that venue over on the east side of London. US record industry revenues were up to $8.72 billion last year, thanks largely to streaming, and largely within that to premium streaming. So that's all brilliant. That's into double-digit growth. Everyone's happy, except the RIAA, who just used their report on this to moan quite a lot.
Yeah, so these are figures from the Recording Industry Association of America confirming that we had another year of double-digit growth in the American record industry last year. But yeah, you're right, RIAA in their blog post on this had another little moan about the value gap. Plus, of course, some of the other music copyright issues that are US-specific, like the fact that AM/FM radio stations continue to pay nothing to labels and artists, unlike their counterparts pretty much everywhere else in the world.
So you can read those stories in full and more about everything we've discussed this week by going to setlistpodcast.com and finding the show notes for this show, where you'll find links to all of them. And finally this week, we've had some more revelations about Guevara and its failed IPO. Not least that it ignored advice from its financial advisors at JP Morgan, who said that the IPO would probably fail.
Yeah, so Guevara is that failed streaming service based out of Australia that was very bullish for a time, had global ambitions, talked up the fact that the other streaming services hadn't truly capitalized on the potential of free ad-funded streaming. But then, as they attempted to grow their business, they decided it was time to float on the Australian Stock Exchange back in 2016. The prospectus they put out ahead of that IPO was, ridiculed from many corners, to the extent that ultimately the Australian Stock Exchange refused to accept the IPO, a very rare decision for a stock exchange to make. And then on the back of that, basically the whole Guevara business started to fall apart and ultimately fully collapsed, and most of its divisions went into liquidation. And it's because of that that we're now finding out all these revelations, because Deloitte, who are the liquidator for the various Guevara subsidiaries that fell apart, have forced a court hearing to investigate what's going on. And so therefore, we've got former Guevara executives in court, in the public domain, answering questions about quite what went wrong at the business and what was said to financial backers while Guevara was still growing. And part of that was analysing what people like JP Morgan, the US bank, had said to the management team at Guevara when they first decided that they were going to do that IPO in summer 2016.
So Guevara's CEO and co-founder Darren Hirft was giving evidence in this hearing. He was asked why, when the company's financial advisors at JP Morgan said, don't do an IPO now, it's not a good idea, he nonetheless went ahead with it. His response was that they were treading carefully with listening to JP Morgan's advice at the time, because JP Morgan had opened conversations with Snapchat about a possible acquisition that then hadn't happened.
Yeah, so I suppose one of the other revelations that came out last week was that a lot of the money that was spent building up Guevara before it collapsed actually came from smaller investors through an organization that Darren Hirft was also involved in called AMA. But By 2015, various investment banks in both Australia and the US were looking for bigger investment, because we all know, and I think the collapse of Gravera has proven this once and for all, it's incredibly expensive to set up and grow a streaming music business because of the costs of growing, the costs of marketing, and of course, the massive royalties that you'll be obliged to pay over to the music industry every month. So having raised lots of money from smaller investors through this Australian entity that Hirst himself was involved in, they then reached out to investment bankers to try and find some big bucks from some big investors. JP Morgan was one of those banks, and they had been talking to Snapchat, who had been talking about putting a significant sum of money into the Gravera business. Talks had taken place, but ultimately that deal didn't come through. And the other thing Darren Hirst did say about why did they go ahead with this 2016 IPO was basically saying, we needed the money, yeah. Because we'd had these various investment banks out there trying to find big investment. None of them had come through with the goods, so we needed to get some money quite quickly. And although JP Morgan were telling us, partly because of Deezer's attempt to IPO in France the previous year, which didn't collapse in quite the spectacular fashion as the Gravera IPO, but it was called off. They announced that they were going to float and then they withdrew from that. So sort of on the back of Deezer, JP Morgan's people were very much saying, don't go with an IPO, you'd be insane to pursue it at this point. But what Hirst was saying was, well, two things, I guess. They needed the money and they were kind of down on JP Morgan as a partner because that Snapchat money hadn't come through.
There was also some interesting revelations about the Blinkbox deal, which is obviously the UK streaming service that Gravera bought. And then it subsequently turned out that they sort of bought it by accident. And Hirst was questioned about whether he told these smaller investors, who were the people who largely funded Gravera, that the Blinkbox acquisition made Gravera more of an attractive proposition. Hirst said that he hadn't said that, but then he was challenged. You at least said that buying Blinkbox was a positive thing that should be taken into account when people were deciding whether or not to invest, and he did agree that he had said that.
Yeah, that relates to other revelations that came out a little bit earlier in the investigation as to what went wrong at Gravera. The fact that Gravera set up a UK subsidiary which went ahead with the acquisition of Blinkbox, the streaming service owned by Tesco, which obviously began life as a startup in itself called We7. And what we've learned as a result of the post-collapse investigation is that Gravera Australia were not convinced about the Blinkbox acquisition, and that there seems to have been a bit of breakdown in communications. Gravera UK went ahead with the purchase, and then almost immediately Gravera Australia said, we didn't approve that. Oh my God, this is not the right thing for us to do. And of course, the acquisition of Blinkbox in the UK was another disaster for Gravera, which actually shut down Blinkbox almost as soon as it had bought it. And Gavera's UK ambitions were basically came to an end.
So yeah, this public examination of Gavera's collapse is not over yet, so there may yet be more revelations from that. We will see, but some pretty big ones already, further confirming that that it was all a bit of a disaster. I think that's a conclusion.
Yeah, I suspect that pretty much the only thing to come out of the whole Gravera adventure is there must be a really good book bringing all of this together and digging a little bit deeper. So Gravera the streaming service, no. Gravera the book, maybe that will be worth reading.
Well, maybe one of us should go and write that now, because we've run out of time for the podcast. If you've come this far, then I'm going to guess you enjoyed it. So why not subscribe to receive the next one automatically to whatever device you're using to listen to it, wherever you like to receive your podcasts. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.